Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From the March issue of Arizona Highways magazine, The Nerve of Mother Nature. For centuries, ancient and indigenous cultures from around the world have used plants as medicine. In some places, they still do. In Brazil, the nerve plant is used for all kinds of things, including headaches and muscle pain. Turns out we have nerve plants in the Sonoran Desert, too. An essay by Kelly Vaughn. Britonia albivenis is native to South America, to places such as Ecuador and Colombia, Bolivia and Brazil. Indigenous tribes in these places use the plant's leaves as a salve for headaches and muscle pain. Toothaches, too. The Matsujenka people live in the high jungle of the eastern Andes and ingest the plant for its hallucinogenic effects. It is said to produce visions of eyeballs. In North American greenhouses and on the shelves of plant people, Petunia albivenis is known as nerve plant. I have a former student, now a friend, named Ingrid Marias de Andrade, who lives in Rio de Janeiro. Although she admits she's not good at identifying the plant she encounters every day, she's certain she's seen nerve plants along city pathways. For a year, Ingrid studied investigative journalism and narrative writing at Arizona State University. Sometimes she struggled with living in the desert and ached for the greens and blues of home. When she graduated last summer, she hopped a jet back to South America, taking bits and pieces of our desert with her. I realized only recently that there is a bit of Brazil in my home here in the Sonoran Desert. Three nerve plants. I like their strange, delicate vascularity and the way they make me think of canopies of trees and faraway spaces and the way the jungle must smell after a storm. Two of the plants live in a vintage terrarium I carefully filled with the right soil. Each week, or 10 days or so, I take a plastic spray bottle loaded with distilled water, open the glass door to their vessel, and spritz. I close my eyes as I do it, fearing that a temporary loss of humidity will put the plants in peril. The third nerve plant sits exposed on the lower shelf of a plant stand in front of our north-facing window. This is its fourth or fifth home as I fight to keep its leaves from falling. Each week or 10 days or so, I place it in a bath of distilled water. I should have just added it to the terrarium. This place is a stranger to damp except during our monsoon, that hopeful stretch between mid-June and late September when desert people look east and west and north and south in the hope of seeing the sweet smell of dark clouds. In 2025, though, we waited. Despite high humidity and some afternoons when the sky seemed to change, the rain was just a tease. That is, until the second week in October, when the remnants of two tropical cyclones, Priscilla and Raymond, combined with a large-scale stationary low-pressure system and made their way into the southwest. The amount of water in the atmosphere was 200 to 300% of what is normally present during the second week of October, says Madison Kaminsky, who's in her fourth year of studying meteorology and climatology along with journalism and mass communications at ASU. This is extremely important in the development of severe thunderstorms because surface moisture is a key ingredient for instability. Essentially, throughout the day as the surface heats up, the moist, humid air is forced to evaporate. Like what you see when boiling pasta, that steam or warm, moist air is forced to rise. As it rises, it inevitably cools and then condenses into a cloud. The more low-level moisture and daytime heating you have, the more energy the atmosphere creates. The more energy that's created means there's more energy that needs to be released. This is sort of the basic atmospheric principle as to why we get thunderstorms. Madison reminds me that it's really not that unusual to see tropical activity in Arizona in October, but she also acknowledges that the severity of October storms was directly tied to that low-pressure system. These severe storms would never have played out the way they did if not for this mechanism, she says. It essentially helped funnel the moisture that was south and north of us toward us here in Arizona. What is rare and extremely interesting is that we actually saw a spiral rain band from Raymond, a tropical cyclone, reach the valley. The supercell that ran over Tempe with wind speeds between 80 and 90 miles per hour and rainfall rates between 1 and 1.5 inches per hour was a direct result of this. And then we saw a desert jungle, wildflowers in our yard, African daisies and poppies, more species from faraway places that went to seed in the spring, started growing anew, reaching that 6-inch height at which the city gets the idea to call them weeds. But then they bloomed, secondary profusion blanketing the wild spaces that turned brown in the wake of an extraordinarily hot summer, the fourth hottest on record in the state. Ocotillos bloomed again too, their tangelo-colored flowers bowing under the weight of rain and renewed interest from hummingbirds and bees. Phocorea splendens, unlike Fittonia albivenis, is endemic to this desert, along with the Mojave, Colorado, and Chihuahuan. The name Ocotillo comes from a Nahuatl word meaning torch, but it's also sometimes referred to as candlewood, coach whip, flaming sword, and vine cactus, among other somewhat less inventive synonyms. For weeks after the October storm, in the low, aching light of early morning, I'd pull open the front blinds to watch two Anna's hummingbirds flutter from our Ocotillo to the yellow bell, to the firecracker, to the spine of a tall aloe bloom, then back to the coach whip. I took to familiar trails once again to run our dog before work. When the rain ended, the desert, awash in its sweet, familiar petrichor, began for me again. The tips of creosote bushes popped with yellow flowers, and the plant once more dropped its fuzzy white seeds. Creosote, Larea tridentata, chaparral. In Mexico, the plant is sometimes called hediondia, smelly. Creosote bushes, like ocotillos, are prevalent across the desert southwest. They thrive in the arid environment, their deep roots capable of pulling water that species with shallower anchors can't access. The plant is toxic to most desert animals, with the exception of the jackrabbit and, interestingly, the dromedary camel, a species the U.S. Army introduced to the southwest in the 1800s. Although herbivores can't ingest it, the plant is considered a nurse species because its leaves fall into piles beneath it, enriching the soil and providing shade for young cactuses. Indigenous populations for generations have used parts of the plant for remedies and its ash for tattoo pigment. Fall mornings become meditations. The blinds, the birds, the ocotillo, the trail, the creosote, checking the humidity in the terrarium, all of it vascular in and of itself, the pulse of a day, a week, a month. Even the houseplant seemed happier, including the solitary nerve plant. Old homes drink humidity sometimes, I suppose. Eventually, the birds moved on to other nearby plants, and I felt in my hands that winter was near. 2 weeks before Christmas, catastrophic, widely underreported storms, atmospheric rivers, pummeled the Pacific Northwest, where my in-laws live. They're no stranger to wind and rain and cold, but in the middle of one Tuesday night, a rare west wind rocked the grove of trees on their property. One, a ponderosa pine more than 75 feet tall, was violently uprooted, crashing into their home and cars. A massive, ancient Pinus ponderosa, the 3.5 inches of rain that fell afterwards further complicated things. But my in-laws are okay. Their sweet, massive Great Pyrenees is okay. The house will be repaired. The cars will be replaced. Where the southwest aches for rain, the northwest suffers from it sometimes. As I write this, the valley again waits. This new rain is expected to last for a day or two. We'll welcome it again in the hope the spring will be ripe with the glow of hillside wildflowers, blooming ocotillos and creosote. Sometimes I wonder if the way we long for rain is greedy, but maybe really it's just a way to feed our imaginations, to transport us to South American jungles or the temperate rainforests of the Pacific Northwest, or to and through the seasons. Also from the March issue of Arizona Highways magazine, we might be up a tree. Cottonwood trees play a critical role in riparian ecosystems. But in the years since the first Europeans arrived, Arizona has lost 75% of its cottonwood habitat. Overgrazing, the damming of rivers, and climate change have all played a role. It's not looking good, but scientists are seeing signs of hope through naturally occurring hybrids. By Annette McGivney. When Spanish explorer Francisco Vázquez de Coronado and his men traveled north from Mexico in 1540 into what would later be called Arizona, they were searching for fabled cities of gold. But accounts from the expedition also noted that they were on the lookout for a different kind of treasure, Los Alamos, the cottonwoods. The towering canopies of green signaled that life-sustaining water and abundant shade were near. Today, Los Alamos are as treasured as ever in Arizona for their beauty, their cooling canopies, and the biological diversity they support. But scientists say that compared with when Europeans first set foot in the Southwest nearly five centuries ago, 95% of cottonwood habitat in Arizona has disappeared. The most precipitous decline has come in the past 200 years as a result of overgrazing from cattle, the damming of rivers, and groundwater pumping to support development. And then there's climate change, which has subjected Arizona's cottonwoods to record heat waves along with record drought. There still are spectacular cottonwood groves across the state, ranging from Sabino Canyon in southern Arizona to Sedona's Oak Creek to Phantom Ranch at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. But ecologist and retired Northern Arizona University Professor Tom Whittem says, "The groves we marvel at today represent just small remnants of what once were abundant riparian oases across the Southwest." And Whittem warns that continued degradation of cottonwoods poses an existential ecological threat that extends well beyond the loss of the trees themselves. Cottonwoods play a very outsized role in the biology and biodiversity of the American Southwest, he says. They basically define riparian habitats. A leading authority in cottonwood research, Whittem has been studying the trees for more than four decades and has documented their role as a foundation species that determines the overall health of riparian ecosystems. According to Whittem, more than 1,000 different species, from beavers and birds to insects and fungi, depend on the trees in one way or another for their survival. If the trees die, then the habitat that all these other organisms depend on is just gone, he says. Yet there is hope. Whittem and a cohort of more than a dozen scientists from Northern Arizona University, Phoenix's Desert Botanical Garden, and other institutions have demonstrated that cottonwoods in Arizona are evolving to endure increasingly harsh environmental conditions. And the scientists are trying to help the trees in this fight through a novel application of genetics and cottonwood ecology. But climate change shows no signs of slowing down, and the clock is ticking on how much longer the cottonwoods and their riparian habitats in the desert Southwest can hold on. Whittem and his colleagues are determined to crack the genetic code in time. In August, I joined four DBG scientists who collaborate with Whittem as they take their high-tech genetic research into the field. We gather at the Walnut Creek Center for Education and Research in the Prescott National Forest, where the scientists pitch their tents near a drainage that's lined with towering cottonwoods. Some of the trees along the creek are around 100 feet tall and perhaps up to 200 years old. Like all mature cottonwood groves, the canopies of the trees form a protective dome over the creek drainage, allowing species to rely on shade and lower temperatures to thrive. But rather than study the well-established grove, the scientists have come to research what they call a common garden that contains dozens of young cottonwoods planted 3 years ago, primarily for the purposes of genetic research. While the trees were watered for 2 years through an irrigation system, the moisture was cut off to some of the plants earlier in the summer as a way to mimic drought conditions. The scientists want to analyze how different species of cottonwoods respond to heat and drought and perhaps discover how their specific genetic traits could better endure climate change. The Common Garden contains the two species of cottonwoods found in Arizona, Fremont and Narrowleaf, along with their naturally occurring hybrids. The latter are unique in their genetic makeup for having inherited traits of both the Fremont and the Narrowleaf species. The Fremont cottonwood, with its broad, heart-shaped leaves, is adapted to desert heat and found in riparian areas throughout the Southwest at elevations ranging from near sea level to about 6,000 feet. The appropriately named Narrowleaf cottonwood, which has elongated leaves shaped more like a surfboard, is adapted to cooler climates and grows at elevations from around 5,000 to 8,000 feet. In regions where their habitat overlaps, it's common for Fremonts and narrow leaves to naturally hybridize as male pollen fertilizes female flowers to produce millions of cottony tufts of airborne seeds. Located in central Arizona at an elevation just above 5,000 feet, the Walnut Creek Center is a natural cottonwood hybrid zone where both cottonwood species and their hybrids could potentially thrive. And by subjecting all the trees in the common garden to the same conditions, the DBG scientists are able to attribute different responses in the cottonwoods to genetic traits rather than environmental factors. I am interested in figuring out how cottonwoods can survive during climate change and where they can survive, says DBG plant researcher and laboratory manager Alexandra Schussler. The fact that cottonwoods span diverse environments in Arizona from low desert to mountain forests allows us to study their adaptations, adds Brad Posch, a postdoctoral research scientist at the DBG. We're trying to find out how hot or dry it can get before the trees can no longer handle it. Schussler, Posch, and I sit under a large oak tree, taking a break in the shade before returning to the common garden to collect more data. The two researchers are weary after rising in the middle of the night to study the cottonwoods when the temperature was lowest. Soon, they'll venture out under the blazing sun when the daytime temperature is at its highest to see how things have changed for their study specimens. In 2023, Posch and his colleagues at the DBG conducted a study that evaluated the ability of Fremont cottonwoods to endure intense heat. The trees were located in a common garden at the DBG facility in Phoenix, and the study fortuitously coincided with a record-setting heat wave in the Phoenix metro area. The temperature climbed above 113 degrees for 17 consecutive days during the hottest summer on record. That record would be broken in 2024, along with many other heat-related records for the region. The two-year-old cottonwood saplings in the 2023 study were well watered during the heat wave, and researchers were impressed by how the trees efficiently cooled their leaves through a process called transpiration. As long as there was ample soil moisture, the saplings pulled water through their roots and sent it to the leaves where it exited through pores called stomata. That cooling system is similar to the way humans bring their body temperature down by sweating. And even though the average air temperature during the study was higher than what Fremont cottonwoods were historically used to, the trees managed to cool themselves as long as the water supply remained constant. However, when researchers cut off the water to mimic drought conditions, the plants began to wither in just a few days. They dropped leaves and would have eventually died if the water had not been turned back on. The study then showed that the key to cottonwood survival is making sure their long roots stay tapped into a constant water source, such as a perennial stream or underground aquifer. Unfortunately, long-term drought caused by climate change is robbing cottonwoods of the predictable precipitation that keeps streams flowing and aquifers recharged. And making matters worse is an increase in groundwater pumping. According to a May 2025 study by Arizona State University and NASA, the amount of groundwater pumped in Arizona has been steadily increasing and depleting underground aquifers faster than nature can refill them. The study noted that over the past two decades, the amount of water taken from Arizona's aquifers is nearly equal to the total storage capacity of Lake Mead. The corridor of stately cottonwoods at the Walnut Creek Center is among the many groves across the southwest showing signs of strain. During my August visit, the rocky creek bed is dry and some leaves are turning yellow 6 to 8 weeks earlier than normal. Even if cottonwoods survive shedding their leaves due to extreme heat or drought, other species, the ones depending on the tree's shade, may not. When we were here last year at this time, the creek was flowing, Schussler says. The leaves are turning from water stress. She attributes the stress to multiple factors: weak precipitation the previous winter, non-existent monsoon rains as of mid-August, and a nearby farmer who's pumping groundwater to grow alfalfa. Once the temperature reaches the low 90s, Posch and Schussler gather their instruments and head back into the garden where rows of shoulder-high cottonwoods grow like corn. They measure the moisture levels on leaves to gauge stomatal conductance, an indicator of how hard the trees are fighting to stay cool. Meanwhile, I duck beneath the domed canopy of a giant juniper where DBG scientist Susan Bush has set up a makeshift lab. She's measuring water potential and leaf samples, another indicator of how drought might be affecting the trees in the garden. As classical music plays from her phone, she places freshly cut leaf samples into the chamber of a device she calls the bomb. Pressure in the chamber pushes water vapor out of the leaf, giving Bush a moisture reading that she writes down in a journal. Later, she'll compare the daytime and nighttime readings and calculate how each genotype in the study stacks up when it comes to handling drought. While Bush continues her work, I venture back out into the afternoon heat, where scientist Dan Koepke is gathering more leaves to put in the pressure device. We walk up and down the rows of trees tagged to identify their species and the location from which they came. There are Fremonts, narrow leaves, and a range of hybrids, including the F1, a first-generation hybrid descended from Fremont and narrow leaf parents. The home territories of the common garden specimens encompass Arizona's varied terrain, from the lower Colorado River near Yuma to the White Mountains in eastern Arizona to Jack's Canyon near Sedona. The trees are genetically unique in terms of being evolutionarily adapted to specific geographic locations. The researchers have discovered, for example, that a Fremont growing near sea level has a different genetic makeup than a Fremont found at 5,000 feet. We know humans are changing the climate and temperatures are getting hotter, Koepke says, as he stares down at two cottonwoods among the garden's rows of trees, one with brown leaves, the other appearing healthy. Do we wait for plant mortality, or do we try to plan ahead and relocate some of these trees now to elevations where they will hopefully have a better survival rate in the future? And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know we feature stories each week for the terrific book, Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called A Garden for Four. It was written by Rain Wolf, and there's a quote here from Katharine Hepburn. Love has nothing to do with what you are expecting to get, only with what you are expecting to give, which is everything. A Garden for Four. In San Francisco, where the houses rub shoulders and squat only steps from the street, we don't have gardens, we have backyards. And if you find a place to live with a backyard that has not been cemented over or gone to the dogs, you consider yourself lucky indeed. 4 years ago, I found a new apartment. It had a backyard with a small concrete center patio, as so many of them do. A leaning fence corralled three sides of the yard. Between the patio and the fence, deep beds held a mishmash of bottle brush and pine. The trees stood in weed patches, and everything was tangled in climbing clematis that was busy strangling sweet-smelling jasmine. This apartment happened to sit less than a block from my parents' big but yardless condo. They had just retired and were busy with bridge tournaments, guitar lessons, and international travel. Dad was still a Hercules of a man, silly, creative, and kind. Mom was the planner. When they enthusiastically offered their gardening services, I was thrilled. I had no idea what would happen next. It started innocently enough. For Christmas, they gave me one of those plastic green scooter seats to save your back, Mom said. For my birthday in February, Dad and my brother spent two entire weekends removing the top 3 inches of bad dirt and replacing it with Dad's good dirt, a secret concoction of who knows what mixed with beer dregs. Mom and Dad got a set of keys to my place just in case they felt like puttering in the garden while I was at work. As spring warmed to summer, I began to feel as if leprechauns had moved in. Each evening, I'd come home from work to find all sorts of garden mischief. A fragrant 50-pound bag of chicken manure materialized in the work shed. His and her watering cans stood at either side of the yard to save steps and arguments about who last left what can where. And our gardening tool collection grew so fast that I suspected the shovels had married and started a family of little spades, hoes, and picks. Had I slept through moonlight work sessions, window boxes changed their dresses nearly as often as I did. And each time the fog rolled in, rows of bumblebee wind whirligigs clattered in beds of purple petunias and pink impatiens. I would wake up early on Sunday mornings, pull back the drapes, and spit coffee at the sight of my parents' dungareed fannies pointing skyward, beginning another full day of planting and pulling. Mom developed a mania for combinations of orange and purple. She planted salvia, marigolds, poppies, golden aster, and lavender. The jolts of color blanketing the yard made my eyes hurt. I took to reading my paper wearing sunglasses. Dad, meanwhile, proclaimed himself paramedic to all sick and injured plantings, mainly because he stepped on them himself in his size 13 work boots. His gardening prescription? Give it another week. But my parents' gardening mania was short-lived. Less than a year later, and just 6 weeks before I was to be married, Dad was in a hospice dying of brain cancer. A ferocious biological weed had sent its tendrils deep into his memory, robbing him of speech and sight. Yet he insisted that whatever happened to him, we mustn't postpone the wedding. I promised him solemnly that we would honor his wish, and we did. I learned a lot watching my parents enjoy themselves, shaping that city garden in their precious last summer. Working, planning, bickering, experimenting, and learning side by side, they built memories for all of us. I realized how much Mom treasured those months when she gave my husband and me a splendid patio set with a gigantic umbrella. "So you can enjoy your garden like your dad and I did," she said with a smile. Recently, my husband, out of the blue, decided to plant a gigantic candy-colored bougainvillea. Nurserymen and neighbors galore warned him that bougainvillea's roots are extremely sensitive and that they often get shocky, keeling over dead the minute they're put in the ground. Sure enough, 2 weekends later, it looked like a tumbleweed, no more than a collection of brittle twigs. "Should we rip it out?" he asked me. I remembered Dad's favorite gardening cure. "Give it another week," I said. Dad and I were right. I think that cheerful bougainvillea will be cresting our fence by this summer. That's called A Garden for Four, written by Rain Wolf, one of the many stories that make up chicken soup for the gardener's soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy. And we'll be talking with you soon.